shout joyful praises to God, all the earth. Sing about the glory of his name. Tell the world how glorious he is. Say to God, how awesome are your deeds. Your enemies cringe before your mighty power. Everything on earth will worship you. Sing a new song to the Lord. Let the whole earth sing to the Lord. Sing to the Lord, praise his name. Each day proclaim the good news that he saves. Great is the Lord. He is the most worthy of praise.
Thanks for being here. We've already had a great service. The worship this morning was wonderful. Thank you guys for participating. So one of my primary responsibilities here at Cibolo Creek Community Church is that I prepare and present the Sunday morning message most weeks. And from time to time, I find myself in a certain tension. You see, I'll have this idea, I'll have this kind of impression that I need to talk about something, I need to address a certain topic, I need to dive into a certain subject. But there's this conflicting tension about the fact that, well, that may not be the most interesting topic. A lot of people may not necessarily see the relevance of the topic to their life. And if you have something that's not of interest to people, and if you have something that they don't see as relevant, then that just becomes boring, and nobody wants to listen. And so I live in this tension about, should I go ahead with this topic that I've been thinking about, or should I choose another topic and find a place and a time to address this thing that was on my heart. And you know, most preachers, they want to believe that sometimes when something's been laid on their heart, that that's from God. And so sometimes you just got to step out in faith and take the risk and talk about that thing that you think needs to be addressed. Here's something that all of us need to appreciate, is that there are things that are important to God that aren't always of great interest to us. Things that are really significant in the heart and mind of God, but are not always that appealing to us. And so as your pastor, it's important that I accept the responsibility of drawing our attention toward those things that are important to God, even though they may not be of significant interest to us. Does that make sense? So there's this word that we use around church a lot. But I'm not really sure that most of us really know what it means. We don't really understand how it works. And like I said, a lot of times we don't even understand its relevance to the rest of our life. And that word that I'm thinking about is the word worship. We talk about worship a lot at church. We talk about worshiping God. We read in the Bible that people worshiped Jesus. Every Sunday we host worship services. We have a worship leader. We have a worship band. We sing worship songs, and we do worship music. We often talk about acts of worship, like giving is an act of worship, and serving is an act of worship, and helping other people can be an act of worship. And then from time to time, in the course of conversations, we might talk about living our life as an expression of worship. But what does that mean? Does any of us really understand how that works? And what's even more intriguing to me is that most of the time, when we talk about the word worship, we almost always talk about it in reference to something we do on a Sunday when we are at church in relationship to God. But would you like to hear the harsh reality? Anybody? The harsh reality is that for most Christians, much of their worship occurs on days other than Sunday, outside of the church, and often has little or nothing to do with God. Did you understand that? That while we most often think of worship as something that we do on a Sunday at church, the reality of what worship really is, in many of our lives, mine included, has little or nothing to do with church, consumes Monday through Saturday, and oftentimes, if we're honest, it has nothing to do with God. And that's a serious problem. And that's why I thought we need to talk about it. So it's interesting, from time to time, I get into conversations with people, maybe not necessarily people who go to church, who may not necessarily identify as Christians. We get to talking about topics like faith and God and religion, spirituality. And I'm always intrigued by the number of people that I have these conversations with that they inevitably want to reassure me that they're a good person. They say, Paul, I know I may not be a Christian like you describe being a Christian. I don't really go to church much. It's never really been of interest to me. But I want you to know I'm a good person. And I'll usually affirm that. I was like, I'm probably pretty sure you're a good person. But what really intrigues me is how often people who aren't particularly religious, how often their baseline for appraising themselves to be a good person is often the Ten Commandments. They'll say to me, Paul, I'm a good person. I live by the Ten Commandments. And I say, you do? And they'll say, yeah. And I'll say, like, all 10 of them? And they're like, well, yeah, isn't that the point? And I'm like, so tell me which ones are you like most committed to? And it's always intriguing to me that their frame of reference is typically like the last five. So like, they'll often say, well, Paul, I've never murdered anybody. And I'll go, phew. So you've never murdered anybody? I'm like, no. I'll say, have you ever hated anybody? And they'll be like, well, yeah, but like, that's my ex-wife. But why is that a deal? And I'll say, oh, I was thinking about a time when Jesus said, if you hate, it is to kill. And they'll backpedal very quickly and say, well, yeah, well, maybe you just interpret that differently than I do. Like, okay. And then they'll say, well, I've never committed adultery. I've been faithful to my current wife now for 20 years. I said, you've never, ever. No, never, ever. I'll say, you've never, ever, like, looked at another woman and thought, I wonder what she's like in bed. Well, I can't say I've never done that, but that's not adultery. And I go, well, again, I just, Jesus one time said, if a man looks at a woman to lust after her, he's already committed adultery. Well, again, that's how you interpret the Bible. I don't know that I'd make the same equation. And I've never stolen. This typically gets interpreted as never lied. But that's not really the essence of the command. They said, I've never coveted. I said, never? You've never coveted? No. I've had a great life. I got lots of the stuff that I want and need. And I go, you've never, ever been in somebody else's house and thought, sweet, I wonder what that's like to live here. You've never seen somebody else's car and thought, man, I wonder how much they paid for that. I'd love to drive one. You've never? Again, it's like, well, you just see it differently than I do. I go, okay. I go, what about the other ones? Do you honor your father and mother? And they're like, well, of course. I think the world of my parents, they're getting older now. We help them a lot. I always speak very highly of my parents. I go, well, what about, do you keep the Sabbath? And they always say, well, I'm not Jewish. And I'll say, well, that's not a Jewish command. Do you keep the Sabbath? Well, what do you think that means? And I say, well, it was about taking a day to rest. And they're like, oh, well, then I do that. Like every Sunday, I rest. I sleep late. I make myself a big breakfast. I sit around in my undershorts reading the newspaper. Then I watch football all day. I just like game after game. I hardly even get out of the chair. We eat a bunch of food. Oh, I know how to rest. And I go, you think that's what that's about? Well, I rest. I go, I think God had something bigger in mind, that the rest would be something centered around him and his place. I say, do you worship idols? They look at me like I'm crazy. They're like, I'm not some like inhabitant of a distant jungle. I don't have like my little shrine in my house with my carved image. I go, okay, do you have any other gods before God? Well, I don't necessarily see God like you see God, Paul. I go, I know, but do you have anything ahead of the God who gave the Ten Commandments in the first place? And they never really know quite what to say. I mean, let's look at like Exodus chapter 20, where the Ten Commandments are presented. Now listen to me, okay? You listening? Because this is important. The Ten Commandments, the significance and the implications of the Ten Commandments has changed after the cross. When Christ did his work on the cross, there was a change in how people came into a relationship with God. It was no longer centered around obedience to the law or the Ten Commandments as an expression of the law. But nowhere ever has God ever revoked the principles of the Ten Commandments. He's never said, okay, now you can have other gods before me. He never said that, okay? They're still in effect by way of principle or guidance for priorities and expressions of our life. So here's what the Ten Commandments say. You shall have no other gods before me. The God who's giving the Ten Commandments, you can't have anybody else higher up on the list than me. You shall not make yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven or on earth, beneath or down even in the waters, nothing. You shall not bow down to them or you shall not worship them. For I, the Lord your God, you need to know I'm a jealous God. And the writer of Exodus would have struggled with like, what word do I use to describe God's intense passion about the place that he holds in our life? And the word that best fit the situation to say, I am very protective of where I fit in a person's life. So some interesting observations to get us started. Worship is not confined solely to God or even to religion. No other gods you shall worship, something else. So it's not solely confined to God. Secondly, it is possible for God not to be the sole recipient of a Christian's worship. That's possible. We cannot just assume that because I identify as a Christian that God is the sole object of my worship. And thirdly, idol worship is rampant among Christians. So if that's true, then it makes sense to me that we should probably talk about worship. And we should probably figure out what idols are, and we should probably try to make sense of what idol worship is. That's why I thought we should have this discussion. Does it make sense? Or are you mad at me? So let's talk about this a little bit. We're going to talk about it today, and we're going to talk about it next Sunday. Now, it's interesting. The word worship appears 179 times in the Old Testament and 75 times in the New Testament, which just by the law of repetition shows that it's an important topic. It comes up a lot. So what I thought we would do, you ready? What I thought we'd do is today we're going to look at each of the 179 times it occurs in the Old Testament, and then next Sunday, it'll be easy, we'll just have 75 times to look at it. Would you be interested? No, because that would take us like 5 hours, and you're not going to sit here that long. I just know that. You don't even like sitting here for 45 minutes, okay? So we're not going to do that. So you don't have to, but would you trust me that I could summarize the 179 times for you? Now, if you don't trust me, that's fine. I can give you the 179 verses, and you can go do the work yourself. Okay, I'm not being snarky. I'd be happy to make that possible for you. So 179 times the word occurs in the Old Testament. Let me just give you a summary. Now, there's a couple of things, okay? It's 100, almost 200 times. Okay, so here's a couple of things that you'll find about worship in the Old Testament. The first one is that God declares that he alone is to be the sole recipient of our worship. We just looked at that. It's the essence of the Ten Commandments. Secondly, when the nation of Israel, sorry, my voice just cracked. I'm just now going through puberty. It's an amazing thing. I'm much younger than I appear. Okay, when the nation of Israel worshiped God, he blessed them. But when they worshiped idols, he disciplined them. When the nation of Israel was active at worshiping God, he caused their crops to be plentiful. He caused their women to be healthy in childbearing, and the babies lived. He caused their armies to be victorious in war. They prospered as a nation. But whenever they got distracted and they started worshiping idols, then those things didn't happen for the nation of Israel. Their crops died. Their babies died. Their armies lost. God frequently confronted the nation of Israel about their worship of idols. This is something that you see from Genesis to the book of Malachi. Over and over and over again, God confronts the nation of Israel. Do not worship idols. And they were prolific at worshiping idols. The Old Testament is full of examples of people who worship God to demonstrate. Sometimes they worship to demonstrate repentance. Sometimes they worship to seek God's favor or his blessing. And sometimes they worship to express gratefulness. God had done something for them, and they worshiped as a way of saying, God, I thank you. So worship has a number of different expressions. Worship throughout the Old Testament was expressed in acts like sacrifices, offering animals as sacrifices, bringing offerings to the altar or to the temple. Worship in the Old Testament is almost always celebrations, like big parties. Did you hear that? Big parties, like fun things. And then acts of obedience. People who experienced either physical or spiritual help or healing from Jesus. Now we're moving into the New Testament. Here's what we see about worship. When somebody benefited from the miraculous work of Jesus in their life. They all always demonstrated their gratitude to God in some expression of worship, like bowing down before him and worshiping him. The New Testament clearly instructs Christ followers to live their lives as an expression of worship, not just Sunday morning, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Live your life, raising kids, your marriage, handling your money, going to work, was to be done as an expression of worship. And then the last one, the Bible declares that every human being in history is destined to bow in worship before Jesus Christ as the Lord of all. There you have it. That's like everything that the Bible teaches about worship. So you know how this works, right? You know how the Bible came to be? Okay, so when the original authors were writing records or documents that would later be included in the Bible. Excuse me, this is bugging me. It's not toilet paper, so just, okay. That's everybody's nightmare, isn't it? Okay, let's see if we can recover from that. So when they were writing the Bible, like they were writing the letters of the Bible, they were being written in the language of Hebrew, or in the New Testament, the language of Greek. Right? So along comes these scholars centuries later, and they think to themselves, wouldn't it be nice if the Bible was translated into English? Well, they had to translate from Hebrew and Greek. So first of all, they had to understand, what did the Hebrew word mean, and what did the Greek words mean? Then they had to find an English meaning that was equivalent, and then they had to find a word, an English word that would capture the essence of these Hebrew words. So just probably more than you want to know, but the predominant word for worship in the Old Testament is a Hebrew word that means to lay prostrate, like literally to lay on your face, in homage to royalty. It was something that you did in the presence of kings. It's a word that means to bow down or to fall down flat. That was the word they had to work with. In the New Testament, the word meant to kiss, to fawn, or to make a fuss over, to crouch to pay homage, to give reverence or adore. That was the word that the Hebrews and the Greeks used to describe what they were writing in the Bible. Did you follow that? So then, here's what the translator said. Okay, we need a word that somehow captures this idea of bowing down, laying prostrate, to kiss as an humble expression of reverence to a king. That's the word we're looking for. So what they did is they chose a word. They chose an old English word, and it was the word worship. And the meaning of the word is the idea of showing somebody honor, to give something great worth, to assign or recognize the worth of something. Did you follow that? So when we read the word worship in the Bible, it was a word chosen to try to establish the worth of something. So worship is an attitude or an act reflecting one's deep admiration of and devotion to the worth of someone or something. Now, if that's too fancy, let's try this. Worship is making a big fuss over a big deal. You get that? What worship is at the heart of it is about making a big fuss over something that we think is a really big deal. You get that? Okay, watch this. We can worship anything or anybody to whom we assign great worth. It doesn't have to be God. Whenever we end up making a really big fuss over something that we think is a really big deal, and we make a bigger deal of it than God, we've assigned it worship. Did you follow that? That's why it is possible to worship the home that we live in. Because it gets more of our time and our energy than we actually give to the God that we serve. This is how we can end up worshiping our career. You ready? This one's hard. This is why we can end up worshiping our children. Or our money. Because we assign to it greater worth than God. So it's interesting, when you look at worship throughout the Old Testament, there was some common characteristics. They almost always involve something to do with sacrifice, like giving something up, to give something up of value. When you worshiped, you gave up something that was important to you. So sacrifice, obedience. Worship always had an expression of obedience, to follow the instructions of or to be in service to. It had this idea of admiration, to be fascinated with or in awe of. It almost always includes expressions of praise, to speak highly of. Like that's essentially, in so many places, that's what the book of Psalms is. It's these recollections of somebody speaking highly of God. Exuberance. Don't miss this. This is profound in the Old Testament. To be excited about, to be elated over, an enthusiasm, emotionally and physically demonstrative. If you look at worship in the Old Testament, it's almost always some sort of exuberant, exciting expression. We're going to talk a little bit more about that next Sunday, but it's something that people put themselves into. They don't worship God in the Old Testament passively. They get into it. So it's possible that we can make a great sacrifice of things that are important for something other than God. It's possible for us to give allegiance and obedience to somebody other than God. It's possible for us to go on and on in praise and exuberance over something other than God. Now, folks, listen to me, because I want to be fair here, and I don't want you to misunderstand. That's not to say you can't get excited about other things in life. It's not to say that you can't give your best and your most to something other. But when it supersedes what you give to God, to the place of importance and worth that he holds in his life, then we've stepped into dangerous territory, because now we have a God before our God. So here's a way I define an idol. An idol is anything or anyone who competes with God for your worship. Anything or anybody that competes with God for your sacrifice, for your praise, for your exuberance. When we get all worked up over something other than God, or we get worked up over something more than we ever get worked up over God, then we have established something as an idol in our life. Idol worship is granting somebody or something greater worth than God. Does that make sense? So the list is long. These are very common idols in the culture of America. We bow down to the pleasure, to the God of pleasure. We will go to great lengths to make sure that we're comfortable, that everything's convenient, at the neglect of things that are more important. The number of hours that some spend watching television And yet when we come to church on Sunday, we're like, they're 5 minutes over. And when it's, they're 5 minutes over because I have, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be snarky, but they're 5 minutes over and I have a game that I want to make. I have to ask, what's more important? We have to be honest to this stuff. We just pick anything on the list. It's possible that any of these can become the object of sacrifice that we make. How many professionals, men and women, has sacrificed a growing healthy relationship with their kids for their career? How many people have sacrificed a growing, stable relationship with God because of the pursuit of success? If I have time for God, if I have some energy left over for God, if I have something, it'll always have to come after my higher priority, and that is my career. Hobbies. Folks, just in the spirit of confession, I have struggled with this in my own life. Because the rationalization that accompanies it is so profound. You think, hey, I deserve a break. I deserve to rest. But when a hobby supersedes the importance of my commitments to God in my life, then that hobby's become an idol. And sometimes for some people, we just make ourselves the God. Anytime, listen to this is important. Anytime a Christian, you ready? Anytime a Christian establishes that they're going to do something, believe something, practice something that they know is contrary to what God has revealed in his word, they have just established themselves as more worth. Did you follow that? Folks, don't miss that. I'm just trying to be careful because I'm not here to tick you off. Listen, anytime that we assume a political position that runs contrary to the truth of God and his word, we have established ourselves as smarter than God. And that our politics hold greater worth. And that comes to bear on critical issues of American society and the lives that we live. And what we stand up for and what we protect. So let's just do a quick review. God clearly establishes in the pages of the scripture at a foundational level that we are to have no other gods before him. That we are to worship him and him alone, and we are not to worship idols. That worship is essentially about a spirit of our heart, an attitude of our mind, and a posture of our lives, where what we are saying in so many words is that we are willing to lay down face to the ground in humility before God because he alone has that worth to us. He's that big of a deal. And any time that we choose to lie down prostrate in humility and subservience and obedience to anything other than him, we have just removed him from his place and we've put something else higher. So the question I have for all of us, and we'll dive more into some of this next Sunday, assuming you'll come back. And I promise you, we're just going to do this 2 weeks, then we'll move on. Here's a question for all of us. Here's a question for me, as much as it is for you. Is God the sole recipient of your worship, or is there an idol or two in the way? So we have a few minutes left, and I'd like to ask us to go somewhere. I'd like to ask if you'd bow your head. And I'm going to give you a few minutes for you to have an honest conversation with God. And while you pray, let me just give you a couple handles to hang your thoughts on. In the privacy of your head and your heart right now, is there some question about whether, in fact, God is the sole recipient of your worship? Is there some sort of haunting or disturbing thought that maybe something else is getting an unusual amount of your energy, your time, your focus at the neglect of God? Is it your job? Is it your kids? Is it your social activism? Is it your career? Or your marriage? Is it about all the time and energy you put into your physical appearance? God whispers to our soul, "You shall not have any other gods before me. You shall not make any idols, bow down or worship them. For I am the Lord, your God, and I'm a jealous God, deserving of everything that you have in worship." So with your head bowed and your eyes closed, I ask you to just wrestle with this question. What would have to change . Where could you start this week to return God back to his rightful place in your life? Our Father in heaven, you are a great and mighty God. You created the entire universe and saw fit to place us in it. Each day we are the recipient of your outrageous love and your amazing grace. You provide for our every need. You, in fact, arrange for every opportunity that we enjoy, from our jobs to our children to our health. We owe you everything. You're a really big deal, deserving of us making a really big fuss over you. God, if we have allowed something or somebody else to take your place, to receive more from us than you receive, forgive us. We confess to you. And in your amazing grace, we ask for your help again to restore you to that place of prominence in our life. God, I ask that you will help me, and you will help our staff, and you will help the leaders of our church to create a place where a community of people can gather and give you all the worship that you rightfully deserve. That we would not take any of the glory to ourselves, but we would give it to you and to you alone. May you receive it in our praise. May you see it in our service. May you see it in our obedience. That here in our hearts, in this place, there is no other God before you. And I pray and ask this in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, our Savior. Amen. Thanks, gang. We'll see you next Sunday.